rain going on. That was something else, but so much for grilling out, you know, hamburgers and hanging out in the patio today, right? The Gospel of John, as we continue our study, we are going to just really kind of just finish up the overview and finish up those broad outlines that we've been talking about. And then, unfortunately, I've got a training class for United, and we're going to end up having to transition. I don't know if this class will continue or if somebody will just pick something else up and run with it. But at least with this background, reading through John, maybe your appreciation will be a little bit different, might be a little bit brighter, a little clearer around the edges than it was before, which is kind of our hope, because I think this is very important. Along with that, I think we've had several questions about some of the background material that I've brought up that I think some of you are interested in, some of it being the Samaritans themselves. And so just for a quick review, I'll add a couple of things to this. You know, if you go back to 2 Kings chapter 17, of course, there that's when I threw out to you the plague of the lions. Sargon II, who we know from secular history, is the individual that actually completes the downfall of Samaria and just obliterates, you know, the Samaritan towns and the capital of Samaria. He carries them off in captivity. Of course, the Assyrian, they had already taken Babylon. They had already taken the Chaldean people. And Babylon had been an ancient power. And then at this time, the Assyrians take over. But Babylon will rise again, as we'll see, and then God will use them in 606 BC. But at this time, in 721, the Assyrians come in, take over the northern kingdom of Israel. They had always been worshiping the calf since Jeroboam's day. Every one of those kings, bad king, all the way down the line, had just absolutely been idolaters. And those things that God hates is idolatry. And so when Assyria comes in, it's almost as if God can't stand it because these people are just idolaters. And so then that's why he brought in these beasts to try to get them to rethink their situation. So they send off and they said, all right, we're going to bring in a priest. We'll bring him down into the land of Samaria because he'll teach us and keep the name of God of this land alive. And that's kind of the way they thought of it. And so this priest does come down. And so that's why Jehovah's name was continued to be written there, thought of, but it was just amalgamated with all of these world religions and paganism, all this idolatry and the burning of the children. All these things kept going on. And so right down through the ages into the intertestamental period. Now, when we talk about Mount Gerizim and some of the places that are going to happen here, realize how important they are. When we first start learning about Mount Gerizim and Ebal, those two mountains are important in Israel's history. And we know that because when Joshua comes out and comes into the promised land, then God tells them there's certain things that are going to happen at these mountains, right? And what are they? They're going to have the cursing, and they're going to have the blessing. And he names them off, and he says one's going to be from Mount Ebal, which is what? The cursing. And then the other, Mount Gerizim, is going to be the blessing. And then the way that actually was executed later on in Leviticus, we see, is when the tribes line up, or actually in Joshua, the tribes line up, and they're actually against the mountain. So they're not on top of the mountains, but they're towards that side. The Hebrew words there can really mean it's not really on, but it's towards. So they're standing on that side. You have six tribes on one side, six tribes on the other. You have the priests, the Levites in the middle with the ark. And so here they are in the middle, and you have one on Ebal, which is the cursing, and one on Gerizim, which is the blessing. So if I were to ask you right now, knowing that background, where did God later on say he would put his name and command an altar to be built? On which one of those mountains? You see, if you read the Samaritan Pentateuch, it's going to tell you that he told you to put his name on Mount Gerizim, and he built there an altar, Joshua did, for Jehovah. Now, if you go back in your Bible, you're not going to read Gerizim. You're going to read something else. Why is that? The Hebrew text, which I take to be uncorrupted, said, even though it may not seem that way to you, he said Mount Ebal. We said, wait a minute. That was the mountain of cursing. And you're telling me that God had his altar there and not on Mount Gerizim. But that's the way it reads. And like I said, it wasn't necessarily on the mountains, but it was against those sides. All the blessing and the cursings were was to try to get both sides of it as the Levites came down. Probably smaller and littler to do with the mountains themselves, because where was Shiloh? Shiloh is over there as well, somewhere in that mountain range. And so that's where his name is going to be. That's where the tabernacle is going to be. So you can see where the confusion starts, even to the point where godly people looking for answers might kind of scratch their head and say, well, wait a minute, maybe the Samaritans have a point. Maybe the altar is on Mount Gerizim. Maybe that's where it was supposed to be. Maybe their text is right. And that's where God had his name. And so there's this confusion, and they're always fighting this thing out. Now, as we come down to the intertestamental period, of course, right before that, you see Ezra and Nehemiah rebuilding Jerusalem, the walls, the temple. They're battling with these individuals, and one's Sanballat, and he is the governor of Samaria. He is a Samaritan. He's an individual that has been brought in by the Assyrian government, and he's there to kind of control what's happening. He's the one that's badgering them about building the walls and building the temple. And at first, you see, they came to him and they said, what? We're going to join you with this effort. And they said, well, you have nothing to do with this. You have nothing to do with this. We are going to go on and do our thing. You just leave us alone. So you could tell the true heart of those people, because then they just turn on them, and everything they do at that point is to tear down their efforts, everything. They begin to write, right? They write back to Xerxes, they write back to all the kings. They're saying, look, this is what's happening. They continue that battle, a political battle to shut them down, and they're successful for a while. But then under Darius II, they start rebuilding again, and this is happening. And while this is going on, Ezra comes up, and of course Nehemiah does the same thing, and they are absolutely furious with the priests of Israel. And why is that? Because they have taken foreign wives, right? They've intermarried, they've intermingled. And he told them from the very beginning, he says, I'm going to give you this land, and when you go in there, you don't do this. You don't have these kind of, you know, the social intercourse with these people. We don't want you mingling with them. You don't want mixing with them. You don't want to be influenced by them. And you're certainly not going to marry them, because they're going to drag you off into paganism, into idolatry. And that's exactly what happens. And so now Ezra's telling them, you put away the foreign wives, even those that had children by them. And Nehemiah says the same thing, but there's an individual in the end that stands up and says, well, yeah, I'm not going to do it. That individual was from the priestly class. His name was Jada. And Jada has the daughter of Sanballat. So he's the son-in-law of this governor of Samaria. He says, you know what? That's too much for me. That's too extreme. No, I'm a religious person. No, I believe in God. I get the whole thing. But that's too extreme. You guys have never heard that, have you? Well, he goes off, much like a modern-day individual, and he says, well, you know what? If I can't please God here, then I'm gonna do it my own way. So he runs off, and he goes over, and he says, how about just making me high priest over here in Samaria? And that's exactly what happens. So he's made high priest in Samaria, keeps the wife that he wants to, pushes off Israel, and starts this community again. And then and when Alexander Great comes along, still in the intertestamental period, then they get Alexander Great's blessing to do what? They build a temple. And where's that temple going to go? It's going to go up on Mount Gerizim, right? Where their Pentateuch said, corruptedly, that's where the name of God would be, and that's where the altar was built. And they said, well, where else would it go? Mount Gerizim. So it goes up there. And then we come along, and then here's something else I didn't say last week, but the Samaritans go so far as when Antiochus Epiphanes is in control, and of course he is absolutely abusing the Israelite people, right? Doing all kind of things, just a very abusive about the whole thing and their system of worship. So they hate him. What do the Samaritans do? Here they have a chance to kind of stand up and go, okay, wait a minute, you've gone too far. But what they do is they jump completely to the other side. Politically, they jump to the other side. They write him a letter that says, we've got a temple to an unknown and unnamed God on Mount Gerizim. We have nothing to do with this Jewish religion and their God. And so we would actually propose that we can rename this temple and rededicate it to one of the Greek gods, Jupiter. And then they go on and they say other things about these decrepit, terrible people that are in Judah. Well, that letter is published about, and the Jews know it, that are in Judah. So you can only imagine how they feel when your political enemies and oppressors now, you've got these people that are kind of got your background a little bit, and you've kind of been arguing back and forth, but they've jumped clear over there to the other side in the political arena and made your life more miserable and more oppressive. So it's hard to say who hates who more, but the Jews from Judah are able to then live it out and inculcate that into their daily practice and traditions much more than the Samaritans. So that's why there is a background there that is huge, and it goes back a long ways, and there's a hatred there that is so deep. And that's why if we had a study in Judaism, you would be absolutely appalled that things that the rabbis were writing, in particular to the Samaritans. What did they call Jesus? What was one of the names they called him in John? Called him a Samaritan. That was like spitting. That would be like spitting right now in the dirt. You're a Samaritan. You know, I think you're a foreigner. That's not it. You're not worth the sweat off my brow that drops. Here's dogs and animals, and then there's Samaritans. In fact, when Jesus says that in John 4 and calls the woman and says, woman, she's probably shocked because he uses that word. He uses the same title that he would his mother or other women in Judah when he says woman. She would absolutely be shocked. So that's the background of Mount Gerizim and why it was such a contentious thing. And then, like I told you, John Hyrcanus, when he rebels, of course, the whole Maccabean rebellion thing, he goes up to Mount Gerizim and they just demolish the temple. They raise it. They just put it to the ground. And from that time on, there's no temple on Mount Gerizim, but there is an altar, and they're burning sacrifices as they do to this day. At that time, Herod comes back in, the Herodians, and then Herod builds a temple, but where's that one? That is on Sebaste, and Sebaste is on the ruins of the capital of Samaria. And, of course, the Jews never have anything to do with that. They're like, fine, you spend all that money, you got that temple, we want nothing, no part of it. You're a Herodian, Hasmonean, totally different. All right, so that's some of that background some of you had asked me about last time, so hopefully that's a little bit somewhat enriching to the background of what's happening. As I talked about, we'll do the three themes of John: truth, witness, light, and glory. We may not do too much on the judgment in life, but I will mention it. When you read John and you go through John, you're going to notice that these are three themes that continue to go throughout the gospel. John writes like no other writer, and he certainly writes like no other gospel writer. And he's not just relating events. Luke is very meticulous, and he just writes down the events that are occurring. You want to know what happens, you're reading Luke, it's just as if he's right there saying, this is the way he put his sandals on. But that's not John. John's looking at a big picture. He's saying, get your head out of the small things and think about the big picture of what's happening. When did God introduce himself back into the world? When did he infuse himself? And he came as what? He came as light. He came as life. And that's the way John writes. It's just amazing. And so he's got these themes, and he's going to talk about truth and witness. He's going to talk about light and glory and then judgment and life. Truth and witness. I'll just introduce this, a passage that we talked about before, somewhat familiar to you in John 18. There it is at the Praetorium when he has already seen who? He's seen Annas. He has been sent to Caiaphas. And then, of course, he's going to Pilate. And he's seeing Pilate, and Pilate comes in for the second time to the Praetorium. And he asks him a question, which is kind of interesting. If you're only reading John, he says, are you King of the Jews? And we talked about where he put the emphasis. In other words, many times we write it as if Pilate's looking for information, or we speak as if he's really searching. Like, are you the King of the Jews? Are you the King of the Jews? Are you the King of the Jews? See, it just depends upon where you put the emphasis. But where is the emphasis placed? By adding pronouns in the Greek, you can italicize a word. It's like underlining the word. The emphasis is, are you the King of the Jews? Look at you. You've got to be kidding me. He's mocking him. Now, why would he ask the question? If you're just reading John, don't you stop and go, why did he ask that question? See, you know the gospel so well, you probably didn't do that. But somebody reading John for the first time, like our Arab friend that we said was over in Baghdad, reading it for the first time, don't you think he came to this place and just stopped and said, why is he asking him that? Why would he be asking him that? What does Luke's gospel tell us about the accusations to Christ? He said, you don't pay tribute to Caesar, and he said he was the king of the Jews. Now you know what he's heard. He's heard it in a formal accusation from the priestly leaders and the chief priests and the elders. He's already heard that. That's why this flows. Let me tell you about harmonies of the gospel, though. I'm going to warn you. Over the years, harmonies of the gospel, as good as they are, it's rewarding to study the gospels in the harmonies. But if you do that and just take people's opinion, the first harmony was written in about 160 A.D., which is pretty interesting, isn't it? The first harmony of the gospels, all four of these, harmonized in 160 A.D. But if you read these things, what tends to happen is, well, I'll give you an easy example that you can answer for yourselves, but it'll give the point. How many cleansings of the temple did Jesus have? So Matthew, Mark, and Luke talk about one. And when was it? Is it the end of his ministry, the last week? John speaks of the cleansing of the temple. The cleansing of the temple, I said. When does he speak about it? In the beginning. Now, several things could happen, and this is what happens in harmonies. You have to look at it and say, was John concerned with the time of it? And he's just trying to relate it and kind of insert it as a parenthetical note? Or is he telling you something chronologically that really did happen? Now, Luke would tell you, right? Luke tried to write with what? Chronology, tracing the events out. So now you ask yourself, what about the cleansing of the temple? When did it happen? That's a true question because if you read the Gospels the way I do, it happened twice. It happened twice, and I'll tell you this is what's going to happen. Let's say Derek, who's not here, we'll pick on him. We send Derek to Peru for 3 years. Derek goes into Peru, and he starts teaching, and he goes through all these things, and you got 3 or 4 people following him around, just kind of, you know, just writing some notes on what's happening in the day's events and journalizing the mission. Now, some period of years later, we begin to look at their notes, and we say, well, wait a minute. He said that to this group of kids over here in this school. Well, no, he didn't. He said that later on over here to these people of the city that were actually politicians. If they all have the same background, and Derek's dealing with the same problem in society, do you not think that Derek's going to repeat himself somewhat? If any of you have ever been in that situation, I can guarantee you, you're going to repeat yourself. So what I'm saying about the harmonies is many times Jesus, whether or not he's repeating himself or not, and the same things are occurring and the same things are happening, you have to look at the time of it. Did the gospel writers really try to mark the time? Did they have a different reaction? Were there different people standing there? There's differences in those two accounts. Now, I'm not going to say you have to believe that or not. I'm just telling you that everything that you read in a harmony is not necessarily harmonized. In other words, people over the years have really struggled and tried to harmonize things when they really didn't have to. They didn't have to harmonize them because it could have happened in 2 different places at 2 different times. Easily could have happened that way. We say, well, what did he really say on the Sermon on the Mount? Because it's repeated over here, but backwards. Well, I'm telling you, he probably, for 3 years, he probably preached the same thing a lot to the same people. It's the same message. Well, sure, he's going to say the same things. And so we find that again and again. But that's just an example. So, why did I even get off on that? Anyway, so that's the harmony of the Gospels thing. The same thing with what we call the church fathers. You hear a lot of people proving things by the church fathers. Because they knew somebody that was an apostle of John. They knew people that had seen the apostles and talked with them. They knew people they grew up as small kids in churches that had elders that were appointed by the apostles. And you go, wow, that's as close as you're going to get. And you know what? Every one of them are absolutely wrong on so many things. Because they're not inspired. There is a difference. We can prove a lot of things by the church fathers, and we can see what they were thinking and what they were doing and where the church was going. But realize, I don't care who you pick out. I can come. In fact, that'd be an interesting class. We could come up here with a list. You just name your favorite church father, whether it's Origen or Jerome or Irenaeus or what. You put their name up there. We'd give you a list of things they said that we know are absolutely wrong. And you know what happens with these the gospel harmonizers later on in the years? They took that as gospel. And they said, well, he said he was in Ephesus and he wrote this in this particular time. Did you know the church in Rome was started by Paul and Peter? All of the church fathers said that. What does Acts say? Paul wasn't even there. He gets there later, folks. He didn't start it. He's joining up with a church that's already got a reputation. He even said so. But that's the kind of thing you run into all the time. All right. So here's the question about his kingship. And of course, he says, did you say this of the shelf or did others tell you about this? And then he says, am I a Jew? Am I a Jew? Your own people turned you into me. What have you done? That's what Pilate's saying. You got to be kidding me. You're asking me. What have you done? And then he said, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would fight. But now is my kingdom not from hence. My servants would fight that I would not be delivered by the Jews or to the Jews. When he says that, what does Pilate hear when he says, my kingdom is not of this world? He just asked him if he was a king. Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. It's not now from here. Well, what's he going to follow up with? Are you a king of the Jews then? I just heard something. I heard you saying something about a kingdom. Are you a king of the Jews? Is that this accusation maybe has a little merit to it? And so he says, thou sayest. For this reason I've been born. For this reason, for this end, have I come into the world. To bear witness of the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice. And that's why we came to this passage. Because it ties it in right before his crucifixion, right before the end, when he ties in what John says again and again. It's the bearing witness of the truth. And we're going to see some of those. In 1935, of course, you're familiar with that. John actually is talking there. Does he talk about himself in the first person? No, he never does. Never talking about himself in the first person. He that hath borne witness, he's talking about himself, though, and his witness is true. And he knoweth that he saith true, this is in verse 35, that you also may believe. Now, what do we say about the truths there? They're the same true as the same word? Same root word, two different words for true. Why is he doing that? What do they mean? Okay? He that hath seen hath borne witness, and his witness is true. Meaning, I am an authority, because I was there, I saw it. As opposed to what people claim today, I was there, I'm in a position of authority, that's the truth. My witness is true. And then he goes on to say, and he knoweth, he saith true, meaning precision, accuracy, absolutely correct. Two different meanings of the word. And that is the introduction to this list right here. So let's look at his doctrine, of course. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Even at Harding College some time ago in Oklahoma Christian, you would end up with these Bible students that go in these philosophy classes, you know, and they'd say, well, how do you really know what the truth is? We're all just searching. You know, how do you know? And then with these atheists that I talked with several months back, we were talking, and you know, they said something that kind of nagged at me, bothered me a little bit. And this is what this one individual brings up, and he goes, well, that's why the Bible teaches that the world was flat. I said, the Bible never taught the world was flat. You know, and of course, he wasn't about to give me the time to give him the history of the Roman Catholic Empire and what they taught compared to what the Bible is and how that's all different. But I said, the Bible never taught that the world was flat. And then the other guy speaks up and he goes, well, that's just the thing about the Bible. It just teaches whatever you want it to, whatever you believe. That's tough to start with, especially when they're over talking to you and they're not going to give you the time because they're really not interested, right? That's what I find out later. But where do you start with that? Because what he's saying is the symptoms are anybody can believe whatever they want about the Bible. So the word that he said was it teaches whatever you want it to teach. Absolutely wrong, right? The Bible teaches one thing. And Jesus said you can know the truth. But I've talked to religious folks of the same persuasion. Well, look, I know what you're saying, and this is what we believe, but don't you understand? It's really hard to really know. At least we're all just kind of searching. But that's not what Jesus said. He said, you can know the truth. And that truth is so precise, so hard-hitting, so it's the light of the world so much that what? It is judging the world. Jesus says that later. He's judging the world with the truth and the light that comes. When he told those individuals and the Pharisees, he said, I came that those who see not may see, and those that see may become blind. He's talking about right now, in the world, right now, it's dividing you. Right? And the man in John 9, when he's healed, and he goes from a point where he says, Jesus, the man of Nazareth, he's a man. Then they say, well, who is he? You know, how did he make you see? And he says, well, he's a prophet. And then later they're like, well, we know he's not from God. And he says, well, he has to be from God. How can he do these things? And they're going back and forth. And then they get so vile with him. They're like, you teach us. They toss him out and everything. Because in the end, what is he saying? He says, he goes to Jesus and he says, do you believe in the Son of God? He said, who is he that I may believe? I believe, Lord. And he begins to worship him. He went from, you're a man from Nazareth. He's a prophet. He's a prophet from God. And then he's down on his knees. He's the Son of God. And what happened to the others that saw the same miracle? Well, we don't know if he's from God or not. He did it on the Sabbath, but how could he do these things? And then suddenly they go here, and then the man that was blind is now lecturing them. How dare you lecture us? We're going to toss you out of the synagogue. How dare you? You're not a learned man. We are. And then they go completely opposite direction. And then they just start plotting his demise. That's the truth. That's this truth that can't be wishy-washy. That's the truth that Jesus said. It's not just, you know, we're all just searching. No, it's dividing people. It makes you make a decision. Everywhere in the book of John. The real versus counterfeit in 17 and 3. And this is life eternal. That you should know thee, the only true God. As opposed to false gods, counterfeit gods. Look at 4 and 24. God is a spirit and they worship him, must worship him in spirit and in truth. Of course, she had asked the question. Her fathers worshipped in this mountain. You say in Jerusalem. And he said, what? The hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem. When the true worshipers. You mean the Old Testament worship was false? No. No. It was physical. It was the shadow. And the truth is the reality. It's the spiritual. An entire premillennial doctrine is based and founded on a misunderstanding of exactly that. That we cannot make the transition that Jesus continued to ask them to make. Can't make it. Just like the apostles. When are you going to restore the kingdom to Israel? He's ready to go. He's done everything he's done. He's gone to the cross, gone to the tomb, come back up, taught them. Been there for 40 days. Now he's going up. He's going to ascend unto heaven. You going to restore the kingdom to Israel? Hard to make the transition. So many religions still living in that hour, not able to come past. Like we said last week too, in John chapter 6, same thing, right? The manna from heaven, they want to know, how can their bellies be filled? You know, Moses gave us the manna. Oh, Moses did not give you the manna from heaven, but my Father. But he gives you the true bread. You mean manna is not real food? No, it's real food. It's not false food. But he says physical, that's a shadow. The reality is the true bread, spiritual sustenance. Just like he said in Matthew 4 and 10. Let's look at the, just for time's sake, let's look at the witness side here. Let's look at John 5. We're going to skip back and forth a little bit, but John chapter 5 is absolutely amazing with the witnesses part. Seven witnesses. In 37... Jesus says, and the Father sent me, he hath borne witness of me. We said that was the perfect tense. That means what? He borne witness, and that witness, the effects continue today. It's like a court case that's been resolved. It's done. Something happened. There it was. He's cross-examined. The witness takes a stand. All of it is, it's a closed case, and the effects continue on continuously. Look at 8 and 14. Jesus answered and said to them, even if I bear witness of myself, my witness is true, for I know where I came from and whither I go. But you know not where I came from and whither I go. Here's a real quick deal. I don't want to pass this over. In 531, Jesus said what about his own witness? Was it true or not? You'll get hit with this one, because this is pretty glaring. So in 531, he says, if I bear witness of myself, my witness is not true. He comes up in chapter 8 and he says, even if I bear witness of myself, my witness is true. You heard that one? People come to you with that? So this is my take on this. I think everything is just like selling a house or buying a house. It's all what? Location, location, location. Understanding is what? Context, context, context. In chapter 5, he concedes to his critics the law of Moses. The Mosaic law said, what about a witness? Not that you liar and that you're not true, but your witness is not valid by itself, right? That's exactly what it is. You have to have two witnesses. You can't go to the court with one witness, accuse a man, get by with it. Can't do it. It's not valid. It's insufficient. He said, if I bear witness, my witness is not true. He doesn't say I'm a liar. He's just saying it's not valid in your books. It's not valid according to the law. So what does he go on in chapter 5 and do? He goes, I'll give you another one. God bears witness of me. The works which I do, they bear witness. That's present tense. They're doing it right now. As I speak, these works are bearing witness of me. John the Baptist, you went to him. He bore witness of the truth. I have all these witnesses. All these things, these signs. These things are happening in Hebrews 2 and 4. That's God bearing witness. It's going to continue to have an effect. And then the greatest one that I really love is the Old Testament scriptures, right? I've got it listed there about midway down, 5 and 39. You search the scriptures because in them you think you have eternal life. These are they that bear witness of me, but you will not come unto me that you may have life. That word bear witness in that is that it is happening continually. Not that it's continuing effects, but that it's continuing to bear witness. Continuing to bear witness. Continuing. When Origen debated Celsus and the skeptics, and those individuals like him, what did they use for those debates? Clement of Alexandria debated. What did they use? The Old Testament scriptures. Again and again and again. They kept wearing their opponents out with the Old Testament prophecies. And that's exactly what Jesus said, is they are going to continue to bear witness. You talk to a Jew today, what would you ask him? Who in the world could come that would ever fulfill the Old Testament scriptures better than he, the Messiah that came from Nazareth? Can't happen. There's just no way. And so the Old Testament scriptures continue to bear witness. All right, now I'll get to this. Can you bear witness today? Hold that thought for a second. Let's go on here with what John says, a couple of things. In John 19 and 35, when he said, he hath seen, he hath borne witness, and his witness is true, he knoweth what he saith is true. You can skip down. I'll tell you what, skip over to 1 John 1 and 1. That's not too cumbersome for you. Skip to John 1 and 1, and then we'll go 1 and 2. This is the same writer, the author of the Gospel of John. He talks about the same kind of things, bearing witness. That which was from the beginning, that which we have heard, that which we have seen with our eyes, that which we have beheld and our hands have handled concerning the word of life. Now, when he says these things, he is talking, he's probably battling what we call this, the docetics who are saying, you know what, flesh and physical things are sinful, it's rotten, it's evil. So it just seemed like Jesus came in the flesh. It just seemed like God came in the flesh. And John's writing about this time in the 90s, right? And he's writing and he battles that fairly well by saying what? We saw him. We heard him. And then he said, we beheld him. What's the difference between seeing and beholding? I saw you, but now I gaze. I'm gazing at you. I'm studying you. And then he said, our hands held him. I handled him. Oh, he was here, all right. That's what John's bearing witness to. And we know the scriptures continue on. We know that God bore witness and that effects continue on. So here's my question to you. Before you even ask yourself, can you bear witness? What are you going to bear witness to? that has already not been witnessed. What are you adding to? You adding something that God didn't? You adding something that the signs didn't, that his works didn't, that John the Baptist didn't, that the Old Testament scriptures didn't, that Jesus didn't, and the apostles didn't? What are you gonna bear witness to? It's done. The effects are done. And then you go back and look, what was the qualified witness? Those that saw, heard, handled, beheld. That's just a mockery of religion when people just grab these phrases and these words and they just kind of throw them around. You don't bear witness today. What would you bear witness to? Your feelings at night? You just lying in bed and saw a cloud? Nothing to add. Let's look at light and glory. John speaks a lot about light and glory. 1 John 1 and 5. This then is the message which we have heard of him and declare unto you, that God is light. And in him is no darkness at all. Is this again a theme that he wrote in the gospel? Sure it is. Same writer, right? And if we say we have fellowship with him, walk in the darkness, we lie and do not the truth. Oh, there's another place right there. Do not the truth. Didn't John speak of that in his gospel as doing the truth? Doing the truth. And here he says, you do not the truth. Not something you read or believe. Here the light is. God is light. Now, I don't know about you, but these discussions with people that want to be this all-inclusive and tolerant group say, well, you're too exclusive. And they seem to brag and boast about the fact that they may have somebody sitting in their pews, worshiping with them, working with them, in some kind of illicit relationship. And then they get appalled and they get aghast when you say, well, that shouldn't be. You should not be allowing them into the group, the fellowship. If you're walking in darkness, you have no fellowship. It's not accepting, it's not tolerance, it's not some kind of level of love. It's forgetting and pushing off the truth. It's not loving the truth and the light saying it has no fellowship with darkness. And therefore, we lie and do not the truth. So you could be sitting in a pew all you want, but if you're living in sin and in darkness, you have no fellowship with we or any other that have been added to the purchased body of Christ. It can't be. In John chapter 1, he uses the same words, the same thoughts in John 1 and 4. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. I take that to be that it was the source of life. The source of life coming from Jesus Christ, just like in the Hebrew writer would tell us that all things subsist in him. All things are upheld by his word, which actually means that this world is as it's going right now. We tend to think it's on autopilot. And then when God wants his providential care of his people. But in a scientific way, in the physical universe, there's something that the word of God and the word of Christ is holding things together and keeping it revolving and going. In verse 9, chapter 1, there was the true light, even the light which lighteth every man coming into the world. I take that to mean, well, when Captain Cook sailed around in 1777, 78, he hits like Easter Island. He hits the gods of the Easter Island where they had their arms up like this and they would sacrifice their children on those. He would go to the Aleutian Islands where they had this incestual relationship throughout the village that would just turn the stomachs of the British. But no matter where you go and no matter what you're appalled by, every man in every village and every society has drawn a line and said, this is right and wrong. Now that line may be miles apart, as we see in this society today. Miles apart from where it was in the 40s. But the line is drawn. Every person, even the staunch atheist that comes to you and says we're random molecular matter in motion, will argue about right and wrong. Dr. Ehrman was a perfect example when he debated Kyle Butt. What did he say? He said, well, we ought to take care of the poor. We ought to take care of the orphans. Well, that's quite a statement. from an atheist that says, we're just random molecular matter. No, take what you get, forget the poor. Don't let them have what you can have. What in the world? Where did you get a moral code? Why would you say there's a right and a wrong? The animals don't have that, but man does. And it's the same dialogue that happened before Gettysburg with Joshua Chamberlain. He's talking to his first sergeant. He's trying to get those deserters to join him. And they're arguing about the divine light in the light of men, in the eyes of man, that every man has it. You can cover it up. You could callous it. You could sear it with a hot iron. You could go off into oblivion and justify your behavior. But it's there for every person. The rationality and logic of thought to search for what's right and wrong, to make a determination. That's why if you're going to push God off, you might as well go save the world for the whales or for the environment, because it fills you spiritually. People are looking for purpose in their lives. When they throw God off, they are absolutely adamant about saving the little seals. It's because it gives them fulfillment. You have to have fulfillment. That's there. God puts it there. You don't want a vacuum there. You can't walk around with the random molecular matter and call it good. The source of light and the source of moral purity. In 8:12, again, therefore Jesus spake unto them, saying, I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. He says that during the Feast of Lights, the lighting of the candelabra on Solomon's porch. I am the light of the world, not just this candelabra, not just shining off the side of the mountain. In 12:35, yet a little while is the light among you. Walk while you have the light, that darkness not overtake you. And he that walketh in the darkness knoweth not whither he goeth. While you have the light, believe on the light, that you may become sons of light. So John uses light, moral purity, the illumination. When Jesus comes, his light is so absolutely amazing, it makes people make a decision. And then there's glory, and it's much like, it's tied into the light. As the light began to shine, when John was saying, here, behold the Lamb of God, they weren't sure who he was. Even the apostles, when he calmed the Sea of Gennesaret, what did they say? Well, what manner of man is this? And later on, they're now where else shall we go? You have the words of life. You're the Son of God. You're the Messiah. You know, there's this growing light of this understanding that just continues to grow. And it's the same with his glory. In 1 and 14, the word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld his glory. Glory is of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. Incidentally, in his first 18 verses, which apparently we're not going to get to, but John is going to highlight in the prologue, if you read the first 18 verses, you pull out all of the concepts that you read, and he is going to develop those throughout the Gospel of John. It's like an overture to a symphony. And then later on, the music is developed, and it's got the different depth to it, but the overture is in the first 18 verses of his prologue. All right, well, we didn't get very far, so I did have some really great slides. I probably should have got to those. But anyway, I appreciate so much your attention, your interest in God's Word, and if you have any questions about anything, love to talk with you about it. What a great study, the book of John.